on are either from Louisville or Louisville and Lexington. How about that? And they will present a variety show that you'll talk about for a long time. And this is real entertainment. And please join us immediately after the speaker tonight. Now, when the speaker gets finished, you know, as we usually come up and congratulate him, let's do it on the side here because these players tonight have a lot of work to do up here on the stage. Ooh, this mic's getting to me. Can you hear me all right? Back away? I just heard from about 20 people. I'll do the best I can. Now, I don't know how many of you ate at the snack bar. It's better than it was 2 years ago, I'll guarantee you. The food is good. The price isn't too bad, but they'll be open till midnight. That's a plug for them. I already told you about the film. I don't know which one it'll be first, but we have two films from New York. One is the Bill Story. The other one is an actual AA meeting. Incidentally, you're here already, but anybody that isn't here that's coming in, if they can hear me outside, there's plenty of parking across the street. Okay, 5 o'clock tomorrow, that's Saturday, is the Ask It Basket. I have three baskets, we have three baskets, in the coffee room. They're placed real conspicuously. Any questions you have for the panel, which will be up here. They'll take place here this year. Any questions you have, throw them in the basket, regardless. But it has to be AA, related to AA, not just any silly question. That's 5 o'clock tomorrow. It'll be taking place here, and it will be taped. Yeah, there's three in the coffee room. One in the, as you come in here, and one at the end of the table, right near the registration desk. This is in respect to the parents of the Alateen. We hope they have a good time. They have a jukebox in room G right here. They have a jukebox. They have a little snack bar there. And also soft drinks. The parents are still responsible for the Alateens. Kentucky Conference of Young People in AA, they have a hospitality room here in room 1170. See, I got it in. And that's all from me. Aren't you glad? And here I'll give you Mike. Mike C.
Thank you. My name is Mike Clark, and I am an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome you people to the Promised Land. We had an interpreter scheduled for tonight, and she could not make it. If anybody in here does sign, I'd appreciate it if they would come over here and do it. I know they can't hear me. I'd like for you to join me in a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom. wisdom know the difference. I read to you the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve the common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any set denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorse nor oppose any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. We're going to start off with how it works, and I've asked Chris to read that. There's ashtrays that should be for on all the seats. We'd appreciate it if you'd use them. There are plenty of seats up front here for someone that's looking for one. Thank you, Chris and Robert. I would like to introduce the speaker who's going to share with us tonight. Thank you, Ed. Right there. I've heard Tom on tape a few times. This is the first time I've met him in person. He has enriched my sobriety on the tapes, and I know he will enrich yours also as he shares with you. I don't want to take up no more of his time, so I'll turn it over to Tom. Thank you.
Folks, thank you very much. I'm Tom Ivester, and I'm an alcoholic. Let me know. I'm sure I've noticed that you guys participate very readily, so let me know if this thing's not working, and we'll do something. If you can't hear this, watch him. That's about all. Great to be back in Kentucky. The last time I was here, talk about contrast. I don't know how many of you know Mary, but Mary picked me up at the airport today, thank God. Lord have mercy. If my wife knew that, she'd have a dying duck fit. The contrast is, the last time I was in Kentucky, I was picked up by a fellow that's older in Kentucky, Carter R. Is that a contrast? God knows. I tell you one thing's not a contrast, though. Mary has lived in Louisville 15 years. We got lost. The last time I was here, and I was riding with Carter, he's lived here, God only knows how long. And we were going to an exotic, romantic place called Baghdad, Kentucky. Well, it's exotic and romantic, all right, because it just about ain't there. Carter's only been there, I think it was 32 times. We got lost. When I got to Baghdad, I was kind of sorry we got found. No, it was a great weekend, and I've enjoyed very much the trips that I've made to Kentucky and getting to know a lot of people, and I've got some old friends here and a lot of folks that I haven't met, and I'm delighted to be here, delighted to have an opportunity to meet some new friends. This is the first time I've ever seen when How It Works was a tough act to follow. I met Chris at Baghdad, and he was 90 days sober, and he was gratefully telling me tonight that it's now 19 months sober. That was worth the trip in itself. I am glad to be here. I've got a lot to tell you, so I'm going to talk as fast as this mic will let me. If I get going too fast, you let me know, because I have got a lot to tell you. I've got a lot to be grateful for. I've got some good news for you. The good news is that alcoholics can get well, and I'm one of them. I'm here to tell you that alcoholics can get well from their first meeting. I spoke at a meeting a while back And I didn't quite realize this, but a little later on, a fellow came up to me and he said, I can't tell you how pleased I am that you said what you said. And I said, what? He said, you mentioned how long you'd been sober and that you hadn't had a drink since you came in AA. And he said, I honest to God was beginning to wonder if there was something wrong with me because everybody I knew and heard had been drunk. Well, there are a number of people, and I'm grateful to be one of them, who doesn't drink. That's the way the program works. If we give our lives to this simple program, we can stay sober. So I'm here to tell you some good news. I celebrated my anniversary 11 days ago, February the 2nd, and that made 30 consecutive years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm delighted about that. I'm just tickled to death. I'll tell you, though, it wasn't what I had in mind. I never meant to do this at all. This program worked for me better than I ever meant for it to. I've gotten so doggone good, it's disgusting. I didn't even hit on Mary a time. God, I can't believe it. And I'm not an old man. Well, anyway, that's another story. But I do have a lot to tell you, and I want to tell you about how that happened in my life. I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. I'm just basically going to tell you my story tonight. I'm not going to try to entertain, educate, or nothing else. I'm just going to tell you how this dude came to this program, what happened, what alcoholism was about in my life, what happened to start this process of recovery, and what's made it work for me up to this point, how it works for me in my life. That's basically what I want to do. I don't know exactly why I'm an alcoholic, but when I think back on my life, the thing that I observe is that all of my life, I was always one of those who had that sense of restlessness, ill at ease, discontented with me and everything about me. I didn't like who I was, where I was. I didn't like the people I lived with. I didn't like how I looked, how I felt. I didn't like anything about me. I was always that sort of basically restless, discontented young guy. I was a fellow who was, I believe, ready-made for trouble with booze. Because as soon as I started to drink and found out what it would do for me, it did great things, and I loved it from the very beginning. It gave me what I needed. I started drinking. I had my first drink when I was young. I don't even remember it. But I started my drinking like many do in my early teens. And then when I was 16, I started serious drinking. I don't think it's any coincidence that that was the same point I went in the Army. I had been 16 years old for 19 days when I coerced my family into lying about my age and I joined the Army. I was a young-looking guy. I didn't shave. And I was a kid thrown into a man's world. This was back in 1948. And the Army then was filled with a lot of holdovers from the Second World War. I guess they were survivors who didn't know where to go. And they were a real rough, ragged bunch of people. And here I was, this little old shaved, non-shaven kid that never had been anywhere, done anything in my life. It's no mystery to me why I drank, because it was the great social lubricant. It was the thing that bridged the gap between me and those people. So I started serious drinking along about that time, and I drank seriously from the very beginning. I don't know why, except the peculiar logic that we seem to have. If a little does a little good, then a lot's going to do a lot more good, and I guess that was it. I drank too much from the very beginning. I got drunk very quickly. I don't remember ever in my life having anything that I could remotely describe as a social drink. Now, I believe that there is such a thing as social drinking. I think the overwhelming majority of people in this country drink socially. They drink when they want to, and they don't drink when they don't want to. They drink as much as they want, then they quit. Then there's us. I'm never was a social drinker. I've never had a normal drink. Now, I'm not against drinking. As a matter of fact, I'm all for it. If anybody wants to drink around me, they better be serious, because I'll help them drink. And I don't feel bad about that, because after all, that's where we get our members, you know. If it wasn't no drinking, there wouldn't be none of us. So I encourage you. I know a lot of people who are better folks when they drink. They're more fun. They're easier to be with. My wife, that I'm not going to be with on Valentine's Day, is one of them. She'll come to an AA meeting and she'll listen with rapt attention to everything that goes on and won't understand half of it. She'll sort of giggle along and she'll listen to the jokes, and on the way home, invariably, she'll say, "Well, what did he mean by that?" And she's been in Al-Anon almost as long as I've been in AA. Almost. She is a gal who is basically sort of reserved. She's a Canadian, used to be, she's now naturalized, but she's sort of an aloof, reserved Canadian. You let that old girl get about two or three drinks, she still doesn't understand the stories. The difference is that now she'll even tell the stories when she gets about two or three drinks. She just relaxes, and she's fun, and she's easy to be with. I like for her to drink. She don't drink much now, because she got tired of me trying to teach her how to do it. I really do get frustrated with people trying to drink and don't know how. And she was one of those typical kinds that would go to the grocery store, and she'd go to the wine thing, and she'd go to the wrong end. You know what I mean? She'd get some of that Rebecca Sunnybrook Farm or what, 8% alcohol. I can't imagine anybody wasting money, and I try to nudge her down to the other end where the Mad Dog 20 or the... She didn't like that stuff. You know, they got a new one down our way now that I'm just intrigued with. They call it Kicking Chicken. That sounds like my kind of drink. But anyway, I just worried her to death trying to teach her how to drink. She just quit, and she won't want to drink around me anymore. Once in a while, I can talk her into it. Anyway, social drinking has its place. I wasn't one of those. I drank too much. I can never remember a single time in my life turning down a drink. I hear people in AA sometimes say that they turned down drinks. If they couldn't get but one drink, they didn't want any. Now, that ain't my kind of drunk. I'll tell you that. I don't relate to that kind of drunk. I was the kind of guy that would walk all the way across town on the rumor of a drink. It is the kind of guy that won't take one drink, don't know nothing about pouring up corners to just get a big enough drink to get your right mind back. Now, that's the kind of drunk I was. And I was that way from the very beginning. I drank too much. I got drunk. I got in trouble. I got in fights. I lost jobs, wrecked cars, got in jail. I don't believe I was an alcoholic. I used to think I was born an alcoholic when I got to the point where I knew I was. But I don't really believe that today. I think I was basically a problem drinker. I drank too much. I had the trouble. I was not an alcoholic. I think for one simple reason. I believe that I drank as a matter of choice and could have quit for the same reason. I don't believe that I was fully developed alcoholic at that point, because I think alcoholism is a disease. It's not a bad habit. So I was basically a problem drinker. That was in my 16th, 17th, into my 18th year. And then in my 18th year, that changed and I became different than I had been. I crossed that line that we refer to from controlled to uncontrolled drinking. Now, it was a dubious kind of control that I had, but I truly believe that I could have stopped drinking then and now. In my 18th year, and this is certainly a product of hindsight, I had no awareness then, but in my 18th year, my drinking changed from what it had been to something else. Now, I was not aware of it, and I dare say that to any other observer, there was no discernible difference one day and the next. I probably didn't drink anymore, didn't get any drunker. Even the results were not that much different. But there was a subtle but important difference that started to happen when I crossed that line from problem drinking to alcoholism. And it started to show up in the usual way. I started to become aware, slowly but surely, that somehow or other, when it came to drinking, I was not quite like other people. Not even those roughneck GIs. I did not drink quite like those people. I started to become the first guy at the table to finish his drink, invariably. I started to be the first guy to want to reorder, the last guy to want to leave. And I started to become aware that somehow or other, when it came to drinking, I was not quite like other people. a strange thing to me that we go through a marked reversal in our attitude about drinking. In those early exploratory days, we tend to take a rather perverse pride in how much we drink. And we're very proud of the fact that we're always the last one on our feet. We always drink everybody else on the day. We always have to drive everybody else home. And then all at once, along about the time that alcoholism becomes real, it changes, doesn't it? And instead of exaggerating how much we drink or how much we can drink, all at once we start to do it the other way. And we start to minimize how much we drink. And that's what I started to do. I started to notice those differences. Up to that point, I had always been basically a one-night stand guy. I would get drunk on a nightly basis, get sober, go about my business. I started to get on prolonged drunks. I started to be drunk for nights and days on end. I started to have great difficulty in getting sober. I started to get jitters. I started to have a few brushes with that loving condition called the monkeys. I started to see things that weren't there. I started to have blackouts. And I don't mean going to sleep. You know that. I'm talking about periods of time that I would just absolutely draw blank, could not recall a thing. In my 18th years, when that stuff started to happen, I didn't know it then. But from the day I crossed that line from problem drinking to alcoholism, my life was to never be the same. In the sense that if I took one drink of anything with alcohol in it, I would get drunk. It set up a peculiar thing called craving that happened to me. And I didn't understand that. And I spent all of my life vigorously trying to prove that it wasn't so. And yet the evidence became stronger every day that I lived. I developed the disease alcoholism as an 18-year-old youngster. Now, I believe that alcoholism is a disease, and I don't just pay lip service to that. I believe it's basically a two-part disease. I think it's essentially a mental obsession. Now, I'm an old-time, old-fashioned type of AA member. I belong to a big book group. I study the big book. That's what I relate to. I don't have a lot of interest in a whole lot of theoretical takeoffs on what alcoholism is. My beliefs are sufficient as recorded in the book. That's what I like. I believe I became an alcoholic when I crossed the line. Let's do join in on that. I get enough of this marathon group therapy with how do you feel it. I'm an old-fashioned type. I believe that my alcoholism came into the picture when I crossed the line, and the definition that I like is the one in the third paragraph of chapter 3 where it says, we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. Very simple, very straightforward, very direct, nothing complicated about it, nothing to do with whether my grandmother was scared by a runaway bull or I fell out of my crib, nothing like that. It simply says that we're people who've lost the ability to control our drinking. That's good enough for me. I believe that it's basically a two-part disease, the mental obsession, which basically has to do with a thought that overwhelms every other thought, is what an obsession is. A thought that overwhelms every other thought. And that's how I thought about drinking. It overruled every other thought. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I like examples because I can understand them better. I never knew anything about an obsession until I had one sober. I'd been sober 3.5 years. I was active in Alcoholics Anonymous then as now. I'd been to a meeting the night before. I had to make a trip. It was a plane trip. I never had been on a plane sober, and I guess that made me a little excited. But I had no trauma, no problems, no exhilaration. It was just one of those things. I had to make a trip. It was a jet plane. Never had been on a jet. And you know how they do when they take off. They don't even get leveled out and they start serving booze. Now, drink was the furthest thing from my mind. And I've had every shade of desire for a drink. I hadn't had a desire for 3.5 years. And it was shocking to me when it happened because we got up there and the little gal started to push that buggy up the aisle selling the booze. And she started to announce it. And all at once, I don't know why, but all at once without any provocation that I could see, I was overwhelmed with an urge to take a drink. No, the obsession to take a drink. I was absolutely overwhelmed. and I knew that I would take a drink. And I didn't want to take a drink. I was in trouble. I did that day what I did just now. I took a, there's a 10. That's what happens when you stay sober a while. I only have a dollar. I took a dollar out of my pocket, stuck it up here in my shirt pocket, and I was sitting there like old Victor E pacing up and down. And I was sitting there in absolute panic because I didn't want to drink. And yet I was absolutely overcome with a gut-wrenching obsession to drink. Now, what do you do? That's a mental obsession. What do you do? You know, it says in our book that, I don't know the words exactly, but it says in there that we will likely come to a place, all of us, and if you haven't, I believe you will, that we will come to a place in our recovery where the obsession to drink will be so powerful that no human power will be sufficient, even our own. Now, that ain't poetry, folks. That's the God's truth. And that's what has happened to me on that plane. I'm sitting there clammy and scared to death. What do? Call your sponsor? Bad chance. Catch a meeting, drop in at the club? What do? What you do is listen awfully close. In meetings where people talk about that. Listen to failures. Listen to people who came into that and didn't make it. And listen to those who did. And learn what to do. Thank God I'd been in AA long enough to learn some things. I remembered some suggestions. One of them was, remember your last drunk. And I did. God, what a mess. And then I remembered some advice that said, when you don't know what else to do, pray. And I said a prayer. It wasn't much of a prayer. Only the most profound prayer that man's ever uttered. God, help me. And he did. And he did. And the obsession was gone. But that's part of it. That's the obsession. That's part of the disease. But I think there's another part. And there's a part that became a reality in my life in that 18th year when I crossed that line. I don't understand it. But it's something that happens to cause us to be physically different than other drinkers. And we start to experience a thing called craving. People who are not alcoholics do not experience craving, never will, unless they become alcoholics. And we can't explain it, but the nature of it is that if I take one drink of anything with alcohol in it, I will get drunk. I learned it from the bitter experience of my own life. I tried everything from VO to Vitalis hair tonic, and it all did exactly the same thing. Now, I was hooked, and that's basically what happened. I became an alcoholic at 18, and from that point on, my life was like every other alcoholic's. Maybe a little bit more episodic, maybe a little bit quicker, because I went to hell in a handbasket in a hurry. I stayed in the Army 38 months and then was thrown out with an undesirable discharge, came back to civilian life and proceeded to just drink myself into nothingness. I went the route that most people do with 1,000 bizarre, shameful, embarrassing, ludicrous things that was my life. Sometimes it's hard for me to really believe what happened in my life. All I have to do is look at the two extremes of it. Look at that young fellow, 16 years old, who bounced out of Belmont High School, full of optimism and hope, just like every kid bouncing out of high school, absolutely convinced that I would do something worthwhile in my life, and contrast it to the fellow who eight short years later, lived on the streets of a large city up north, the city of Flint, Michigan. It got to a point that I was unemployed and darn near unemployable. And in the process of it, lost my soul. I'm not proud of it by any stretch of the imagination, but never do I want to forget it, and never do I want to be unwilling to share it. By the time I was 24 years old, I don't know of one single thing, not one, that a man can do that I hadn't done. Not one. And I'm not proud of that. I used to say that I lived by my wits when I was hustling and scuffling on the streets. But that ain't exactly right. I live by my total lack of character. I believe that I would have drunk myself to death if I had not been brought to a stop. I was the kind of drunk who was just so wild and irresponsible that I had to be brought to a stop. That's the only way it was. I was jailed with regularity so many times that I honestly do not know how many times I've been in jail, and don't really care, because it's a rather relative thing how many. One was too many and 1,000 wasn't enough, I reckon. I guess I finally went to enough. I ain't been to jail since it came to eight. Almost, but not quite. That was my life. 24-year-old fellow, and I absolutely resolved to the fact that I believed that I would stay that way. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. Now, I wish that I could tell you that one bright sunny day I just had enough and threw in the towel and called for help and somebody came and then I came here. But that's not the way it was to be. Because unfortunately, as many of you know, I stayed out there a little too long. And I wound up on my way to Alcoholics Anonymous doing the kind of thing that I think every alcoholic in the world fears doing. I never have met an alcoholic who hasn't had a rather morbid fear that somehow or other in a drunken mess they might wind up doing. By the way, that pilgrim did drink. After 12 years in this program, that pilgrim drank. And he has never effectively gotten back since. And it breaks my heart, but it broke his life. So I'm not going to say that, and I hope you don't. I hope you don't, because the sad fact of the business is that, Tom, when we clear this aisle tonight, 51 years of our history tells us, now you take it for what it's worth, 51 years of our history tells us that if you drew a line right down through here, Mary, because you're on this side, everybody on this side will never drink again. That's the way it is. Everybody, I don't know what y'all been doing. The fact is that this group, Scotty, we heard a guy talk about this in Midland one night. This group will never meet again. This is a different group than I talked to up here a year ago and 3 years ago or 4 years ago over in Lexington. This group will never meet. Think about this a minute. When we think about the premium that we put on our sobriety, we'll never meet again. We could call a break right now and reassemble in 10 minutes and it wouldn't be the same group. Somebody would have an emergency that they had to attend to, even if they made it up. Next year, when the Kentucky State Convention meets, some of us will be drunk. I may be one of them. Some of us will be drunk. Some of us will be dead. Some of us will be sober. And I suspect that it has something to do with the commitment that we make to this program. I'm rather hard-nosed about this thing, and don't apologize for it one ounce, because I've been to too many funerals. I went to one Monday, and I didn't like it. A friend, a dear friend, burned alive, drunk, in his house. What a horrible way to die. And I've been to too many, and I don't want one of them to be mine. So I believe that there's a program here that works if we do certain things. Now, what was it that made the difference? When I think back to what it was that turned the key for me, what was it that made this program become real in my life and become vital in my life? What I remember is that this is basically a program of the heart. And when I think back to what it was that made the difference for me, what was it that made this 24-year-old lost piece of human trash come alive again? What I remember is the fact that I remember Shy. I remember people. I remember Shy and the magic of his enthusiasm and the notion that he gave me that maybe, just maybe, there's something here for me. Somebody asked me tonight about a guy named Glenn Coffey, who's been dead now almost 20 years. But, oh God, did he live when he lived. And I remember him and his dynamic power. As he would speak to a group, you rose to the edge of your seat. I don't care what you wanted to do. because the power of what was happening was so great you couldn't resist it. I remember him. I remember Pete. Somebody asked me about him tonight. He still lives. He calls me every once in a while to find out how I'm doing. He's 74 years old. He's had two bouts with cancer, a heart attack, and I don't know what else. A great big ugly Dutchman, about 6'5". A bitter man. He's still bitter to this day, even though he's been sober probably 40 years. A very bitter man. He went to prison as a youngster, and when he was 15 years old, he had his right eye kicked out by a prison guard. And he's never really gotten over that. But he found recovery in this program, and Shy was his sponsor. Hear me. Hear me. Pete Slager, why am I here? For better than 35 years. Pete Slager has driven across the state of Michigan to visit Jackson Prison to carry his message of hope to guys like me. Thank God for that man. Once in a while, I dare to use the word dedication. Fellow alcoholics, I don't even know what it means. But I know what it looks like, and it looks like him. I remember Pete. I remember a little Indian guy, a little frail fellow by the name of Johnny from Lansing, Michigan. He was a dishwasher by trade, a man who was totally illiterate. And we wrote him a letter one time and asked him to come to that prison group, and he came. And I found out that Johnny had left his home at 2 o'clock in the morning to make a 60-mile trip because he didn't have a car. He was going to hitchhike, and he wanted to make sure he had enough time to get there. Now, I don't remember Johnny's speech, because Johnny didn't make a speech. But I remember the message of his life. What did we do when Chris had trouble with Chapter 5 tonight? Think of the response. Think of how we pull for each other. Think of the message involved in that. And that's the way I felt for Johnny and what he gave. He gave everything that he had. He was not a rich man handing out pocket change. He was a guy giving his life. And I knew it. So when I think about why I'm here, that's what I remember. I remember the people who cared, the people who shared, the people who reached out to me when I had absolutely nothing to give anybody but a broken and wasted life. Little did I know that that's exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous looks for. This is the only place in the world that I know where the worse your credentials, the better your welcome. It's to God's truth. It doesn't make sense. But it's to God's truth. So I believe that that's why I'm here, is because people cared about me. This is a loving, sharing, caring program. It does require more, though, than, you know, there's a place in our book where it says it requires more than frothy emotional appeal. It ain't enough to get inspired, charged up because of somebody else. Because there is a program here that will produce recovery if we use it. And I was introduced to this program in a loving way, but in a very hard-nosed kind of way. I was taught the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught, literally taught, the steps. I went to this program for 3.5 years, and I never had 1 ounce of applause or appreciation or consideration from one soul other than members of Alcoholics Anonymous. None. And I'm grateful for that today, because it proved to me that I don't need it. I don't have to have it. There's a fundamental thing here. There is a program that works here, and its results are totally predictable. Totally predictable. If I follow those simple steps, something happens. Now, what started to turn the key for me, what started to bring about some real sobriety, like a lot of things I didn't mean to.
Good Lord. Glad y'all drink funny water up here.
Good. I didn't mean to. I was at a point where I was starting to have some thoughts, and
I was basically trying to figure out how such a nice fellow as me got in such a mess. It's basically what I'm doing. They call that mental inventory taking. And I was sort of thinking about that. And I went to a meeting one day, and they had a speaker by the name of Johnny, who came from Flint, Michigan. He's still alive, and he's a good friend. And Johnny's the kind of guy who's always intensely involved in something. And at that time, he was involved in the fourth step. And I think this was the place where my real sobriety started to occur. I went to that meeting like any other, never expected anything untoward to happen. And Johnny spoke for one solid hour about nothing but the fourth step, about how to take that inventory. Went into great detail, more than I'd ever heard. Read part of it out of the book. He talked about the need for scrupulous, rigorous honesty. He talked about, emphasized the need to write it. And when he got through, I decided, and I knew what he was talking about. I had read the stuff, but I knew in my head what it was about. And I had been sort of thinking about what was wrong with me. And let me tell you this. Where I was at, and one reason that it's so important to write an inventory. You know, our minds ain't right. You know that. There's something wrong with us. And we don't think right about things. Alcoholics are without a doubt the world's greatest schemers and rationalizers. We can scheme and rationalize anything. And I was at a point where I was trying to figure out how such a nice fellow to me got in such a mess. And what I'd thought about was that my mother and father had broken up when I was a young boy, 4 or 5 years old. And right after she broke up, about a year or so later, she remarried. And she remarried to a little old wart of a man by the name of Alvin. He was just a little old sawed-off runt, and I don't mean any offense to short people. They got to live, too. But he was an absolutely obscene man. And I don't mean just the way he looked. He was a very ugly man, but he was an obscene man just the way he was. I didn't like that dude. I knew that that thing was not my daddy. I knew that. But I had to call the thing daddy because I was too little to resist. And I hated that cat. I mean, every day. And I'm not. The resentment is too mild. We got to have a stronger word. I resented that cat. Oh, my God. I promised myself if I ever got big enough, I was going to whip the dog out of him. And then I went off to the Army, came back. I was too big. It had been like whipping a dwarf. I never did get to whip the old fool. He died. And I really didn't like him. I don't even like him dead. I truly do not like that man. And yeah, I ain't even going to make amends to him. So there. So... what I was thinking, and that's what I was thinking at that point. I had other weird things, but that was where I was at that point. I said, well, anybody who grew up under that kind of influence had to be a little weird, and I was. And so what I meant to do when I went back to my cell was to write a little story about Alvin and life's cruelties and all that. But the founders were wise when they said to write it, because I sat down to write and I wrote 2 lines about old Alvin and what I had in mind. And then without any intent whatsoever, I started to write about me. And I'll tell you today, a lot more surely than I would then, that was the most important day's work this old boy's ever done, bar none. Because when I got through with that, I knew that I was an alcoholic, period. And I admitted that fact to myself. Never once, from that day to this, have I ever seriously doubted that fact. That's fundamental. I'm an alcoholic. And I knew that the chances for me were limited. I could drink, of course. But if I decided to drink, I'd better be sure about it, because when I drink, that's all I do. Or I could go the rest of my life and never drink again. And I decided to try this simple program, and I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous different. I went back looking for something. Now, God knows I went back fighting. I resisted everything in this program. I fought everything in it. Thank God I lost every fight. I don't understand it fully. We call it the paradoxes in this program because we really don't work Alcoholics Anonymous. If we're working it and it's hard work, it's a safe bet that we ain't doing it right. It's like playing golf. You know, if you play golf and it's hard work and a strain, you ain't doing it right. The same way in Alcoholics Anonymous. I fought everything in it and I lost the fights. And there was the key. The paradox is that we surrender to win. and you don't work it. The hard thing for us is that we have to let it work and get our willful, self-centered attitudes in gear. The miracle started to happen. The fact of the business is, the miracle's happened for me there. Strange thing to me, but I think it really tells me something about Alcoholics Anonymous. This program worked for me in Jackson Prison, and I believe it'll work for any alcoholic anywhere who will give his life to it. I don't think it makes any difference if you're in jail or Yale. This program will work, because it worked for me there. The first day of freedom I ever knew in my life, I was locked up in a cage like King Kong behind a wall so tall I couldn't see sunshine but a few hours a day, and I knew freedom. I got to rush on because I do want to get you out of jail. And it ain't hard to get out of jail. It just takes time. And I finally did get out. St. Patty's Day of 1960, I walked out. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous the first night. And practically every night thereafter for a long, long time. I knew I was home when I walked out because I went into that meeting the first night. And, you know, I guess I could say that my appearance didn't make a difference because I was dressed in one of those funny-looking suits that they give you when they let you out of some place. And anybody could look at me and tell I just got out of something. And it did make a difference because normally if you get about half the people at a meeting to speak to you, you're doing pretty good. And every person at that meeting spoke to me, and they stuck out the right hand of fellowship, and that's been happening ever since. Thank God for that. That's the greatness of this program, that sensitivity, that caring, that acceptance that's so much a part of our lifeblood. And I was off and running. I got immediately active in this program, and I had some good things happen to me. Yeah, when I'd left Jackson Prison, I had a fool's dream that someday I might be able to get a job, a decent job. And I did. I got a job sweeping the floor in a cotton mill on the third shift. And I was humbly grateful for that job. It was a lousy job, but I was humbly grateful for it. I was active in this program. I immediately started working with institutional groups. Second week I was out, I went over to a group near my home. 2 months after I was out, I became the outside sponsor of that group, and I was highly honored to be asked to do something like that for guys just like me. About the same period, along about 2 months after I was out, I sat in my house one day and a parole supervisor came by and he said, "Tom, you're real active in this AA thing, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And it kind of scared me because I thought he was going to tell me to slow down. And I knew it wouldn't. He said, "Wouldn't it help you if you could drive?" And I said, "Yes, sir, but I can't." And when I left the state of Michigan, they put in letters that tall, "This man is to never drink alcoholic beverages. This man's never drive a motor vehicle." And I took that as a literal fact of life. And I just dismissed it from my life. He said, "Okay. Let me check." A couple weeks later, got a phone call, and he asked me if I could meet him up at a Sears store in Gastonia, North Carolina. Now, this story is true in every detail. I walked into the front of that Sears store, and I could see back to the license agency counter, and my parole supervisor and the license agent were standing back there talking. I walked up to them. My parole supervisor handed me a driver's license. He didn't ask me if I could drive. He didn't give me a test. He didn't ask me nothing. He just handed me a driver's license. I had never spoken to one soul about a driver's license other than answering him when he asked me about it. Now, you can call that anything you want to call it, as long as you don't call it political connections. Now, don't call it that. The only politician I knew in the county was the sheriff that used to lock me up with regularity. I believe it was a miracle. I also believe that if I had been trying to connive that into happening, I'd have been walking to this day. I believe that when you're sincere and God's got work for you to do, He'll tear down the walls. I don't care what they are. When I'd left that prison, among the other fool's dreams, that I wondered if I would ever have a friend. And this ain't just talk. I did not have one friend on the face of this earth that I knew that was a personal friend. I wondered if I would ever have a friend, if I would ever be trusted by anybody to do anything. 5 months after I was out, the folks in my area started to have an election for a district committeeman. I wasn't running for office, barely knew what a district committeeman was, and I was elected unanimously to the job. Not everybody gets thrilled about being elected to a service job. I was deeply grateful for that. And I just finished another term as district committeeman just in January. I've really gone up in this AA thing. 30 years, I still got the same job. About 2 years after I was out, I was sitting in my house one day, and I got a telephone call from our state capitol. The man on the other end of the phone identified himself. I'd met him one time at a meeting, and he had asked for Mr. Ivester, and I got on the phone, and he said, "We're thinking of expanding our rehabilitation program in the prison system, and we were wondering if you might consider taking a position." God knows, I've never been offered a job in my life. I mean a job, not a position, except by some drunk didn't have one himself. And I knew that there had to be something wrong. Rehabilitation program in the prison system. And I told him that I'd rather do that than anything I knew. And I knew deep in my heart that would never happen. But lo and behold, it did. And 25 years ago, I was employed as a supervisor in the rehabilitation program in the North Carolina prison system, first ex-con in the history of our state, most other states back then, ever employed in such a position. For the next 9 years, I had an absolute joy of a life working primarily with guys with alcohol problems and drugs and development programs. Great thrill. And then after 9 years, some people started to come to me and ask me about moving into management. And I never had really considered doing anything like that. I didn't really want to be a manager or a keeper. I wanted to be somebody working with the guys and helping. And they wanted me to be superintendent of a prison. And I didn't truly want to do it. And then finally I saw that perhaps in a position like that I might be able to do more. And so in 1970 I agreed and I became superintendent of the first prison I ever headed. Now that's a long ways from Jackson Prison. If you don't recognize the distance involved in that, that's a long trip. Now, every once in a while, I'll be sitting in a policy meeting or something. We'll be talking about budgets or security problems, and I guess a little moment of insecurity will set in or something, and I'll just sort of think, you reckon they know? There's somebody going to speak up and say, what the hell are you doing in here? That's what I've been doing for the last 16 years is developing and managing correctional institutions. I still do. I'm the head of a prison now. That's what I do for a living. That's my profession. And it's been a grand career. I've still got some stuff I want to do, and it's been a great career. Yeah, I believe that God truly does find a place for his people that's really worthy of their fullest attention. I believe that. The rest of it, I think, is just a matter of keeping on, keeping on. I believe that this program lasts as long as we use it and not one more second. Not one more second. I don't think it's good enough for me to come up here and tell you what I've done for the past 30 years and tell you what I used to think 5 years ago. I think it's got to be current. It's just like money in the bank. You better not write any checks if you ain't putting none in. And it's the same way with this program. There ain't no coast in place. There's no place for resting on your laurels. I'm still as active as I've ever been. And I have some basic beliefs about this program. I think it does have to be current. I'm a member of a home group. My home group is the Big Book Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meet at Brownson Presbyterian Church in Southern Pines, North Carolina on Tuesday night. That's my home group. That's my place. I believe in home groups. I believe that everybody's member is nobody's member, and commitments that are lightly made are easily broken. I'm not one of those who believes in the roaming nomad approach of just drifting around and voting everywhere you go. My home group is where I clean up. It's where I don't do a whole lot of talking. It's where I make coffee. It's where I put more money in the pot than I do anywhere else. That's my group. That's mine. If it's lousy, I ain't going to move. I'm going to stay there and try to do something about it. That's my group. That's important to me. It's a part of my identity. I believe in sponsorship. Scotty, you may not have known this, but in Midland, Texas, when I met you, I also acquired my current sponsor, a nice young Canadian, very quiet, demure fellow by the name of Cecil. And he and I went down to the restaurant and had hot tea for about an hour, and I asked that man to be my sponsor. And he knows that he's my sponsor. No question about that. He knows that he's the man that I want to call when I don't know who to call. I believe in sponsorship. I believe that I need one today. He's the guy who will walk into my house, into my life, unannounced. I've given him that invitation. I sponsor as many people as I possibly can and believe that I can do it effectively. And that's a good number of people. I believe in that. I think it's vital in this program. I'm still involved in service, not because I don't have anything else to do. I'm the busiest man I know. But I believe that service is a logical part of the recovery process. And the extent of success and happiness that I have in this program, I truly believe is dependent on how well I learn to serve. I believe it's got to be current. Let me close. I ain't through, but let me close anyway. Let me close with a story that I think has something to do with about... I didn't tell this for a long time. I don't know why. But I do a lot of traveling. And I do a lot of flying. And for many years, I don't know, Jack, if you've ever run this or not, but for many years, I'd be sitting on a plane, and you know how folks chit-chat, and, you know, who are you, what do you do, and all that kind of stuff. People would ask me where I was going. I was nearly always going to an AA conference. Hey, where are you going? I'd say, where I was going, what for? To a conference. What about? Oh, alcoholism or something. You know, I'd sort of fog it and cover it up. And then I heard a guy say one time, that wasn't real smart to do. And I got to thinking about that, and by golly, he was right. That ain't what anonymity means. No. Anonymity don't mean hiding. Anonymity is a spiritual quality. And I quit doing that. And I was sitting on, let me tell you this story about what that does. I'd done that for years. And then the first time that I didn't, I had to go to Fargo, North Dakota, of all places, in February. That's a thrill. And I got just about fog-bound in Chicago. I couldn't get a flight. I was going to a conference, and I was the only speaker on the program. Only one. It was a one-speaker conference. And I know they'd have got somebody else. It didn't make. I didn't want them to get nobody else. But I told them I'd be there. And I was in Chicago, frantically going all over the airport trying to find an airplane. And I finally found one, a Northwest plane that was going to Chicago that I wasn't supposed to be on. And I got the last seat on the last plane that left Chicago. Got to Minneapolis. And I was standing in the line behind a little girl. And we started to chat as we were getting on our next plane in Minneapolis. And she'd gone asunder in her flight somewhere. We found ourselves together in Minneapolis. We started to chat. We asked her where she's going, all that stuff. She asked me, where am I going? I said, Fargo, North Dakota. What kind of conference you going to? Alcoholics Anonymous. And she looked at me kind of startled and said, my, isn't that nice? And we started to have a good time talking and said, let's sit together if we can. So we asked them about it. Sure enough, they had two seats together. Got on the plane, sat down, and we were still animatedly talking away and having a great time. And the plane was packed. And just before we started to take off, there was a lady coming down the aisle, and she sat down with us. And she was a rather frantic-looking lady, a real sort of just harried-looking woman. And same thing, introduced myself to her and said, who are you? I'm Tom. Where are you going? Fargo, North Dakota. Her name was Kit. She was a school psychologist from Providence, Rhode Island. And I told her where I was going, what kind of conference. I said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And she looked at me like I had stuck her with electricity. And she said, are you in recovery? And I said, yes, I sure am. She said, me too, 7 years. And she was on the way to Fargo, North Dakota, because she'd just lost her husband to brain cancer. And he'd had a very long and difficult illness and death. And she was going to Fargo, North Dakota to be with her family to lick her wounds and get over her grief. And naturally, I just immediately turned to her and we started to talk. And, you know, we can be pretty rude sometimes to those around us. And we don't mean to be, but we get so caught up with each other that we sometimes forget about those around us. And that's what I did. I started talking to Kid a mile a minute, and we were talking about the program. And just before we landed in Fargo, it dawned on me what I was doing. And I turned around to the little librarian and said, "Honey, I'm sorry. That's a very rude thing to do, to ignore you like I have." She said, "Oh, no. Don't apologize. I wouldn't take anything in the world for hearing you guys talk." She said, "What I didn't tell you was that I was supposed to be married last weekend, and my fiancé just didn't show up. He just didn't show up. And I was humiliated and crushed and totally defeated and absolutely could not face anything. And I read in a trade journal about a librarian job in Fargo, North Dakota. And I was going to try to start a new way of life." She said, "Listening to you guys, I know there's hope for me." You see what I'm talking about? That's what anonymity ain't about. This program is a way of life. And it doesn't conflict with anything else in my life. If I let it be a natural part, I'm blessed with miracles beyond my fondest dreams. I've had 30 years of the grandest living that any man could have. I'm 54 years old and one of the happiest 54-year-olds you've ever seen. I am deeply grateful for this program and for your kind attention. I thank you very much.